Hello and welcome to the Countercurrent stream for the 30th of October 2021. I'm here with, well, I'm Millennial Woes. It's not the, your usual host, Greg Johnson. And I'm here with Nix Gilvey. So hello, Nix.
Hello, Woes, and you can call me Nick for the duration of this show.
Okay. All right. Now, there's no special format for this episode. We're just going to go through questions that are posted on Entropy. So, all right, so that's where to post the questions and super chats. So, and we'll be here with you for the next 2 hours. So thank you everyone for tuning in. Okay, we'll just start with, okay, I don't know what was the last ones that were answered last week. I'm guessing that it was, that there is only one from today, and it's Sestofior. I'm probably mispronouncing that. And he says, I hope you meet your goal. Go, go, go. That's the Countercurrent's funding goal. And prior to that, they're all from the 24th. So I'm guessing that Greg would have dealt with them last time. But there is one that I think is quite interesting. We might have a go at it ourselves, Nick. And it's this one. Can psychology, mass psychology in particular, shape a strategy for populist right-wing movements in order to make the transition from fringe to mainstream? What would some basic principles look like? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I remember this particular super chat. It was posted during the writer's block stream I did with Josh Neal on the topic of his book, American Extremist. You know? So I think I already answered this question. But you and I both, Woes, we have been thinking a lot about mass psychology, specifically the psychology of the so-called normie. So I think that having a realistic picture of what the majority of people are psychologically, behaviorally, and socially, we could is going to help us greatly in our political aims, in understanding the nature of our struggle, and thereby refining it. And much of my work at Countercurrents and in these shows and elsewhere has been towards an application of the principles of psychologizing, you could say, of psychological thought, and an attempt to understand the human animal to the aims of our movement. So, I think you did some great work this week, even though it was a little premature from what I understand, on trying to pin down, the human animal and its behaviors.
Yeah, that was based on I talked about it a few weeks ago on my regular show, which is on Monday nights at 10 p.m. GMT on Telegram. And I talked about it a few weeks ago, and it was I can't remember exactly what the question was, but it was about the normie and how, I think it was somebody saying, complaining that he felt very alienated from his relatives and from his friends and his colleagues at work. And I was trying to wrangle with this, what presumably has been an eternal dilemma, which is how should the intellectual, how should the rebel, how should the outsider feel about the mainstream, about the normal, the ordinary person, the apolitical person? And I think it's a very complicated question because the normie might be perfectly decent, a perfectly good person, kind, responsible, well-meaning, intelligent, imaginative, compassionate, all of those things, and yet when it comes to society, he simply believes whatever is fashionable. So he has the most fashionable political opinions on it, on each issue, and he believes that his government is benign and that the system is fundamentally as it should be. So there's no need for any radical change. There's no need to be talking about such things. It's only weirdos who think about such things. Well, you know, then how are we are the weirdos that he's referring to there. So how are we meant to feel about him? Because we see him as this eternal roadblock to change. And I think that's where we make our mistake. You know, we think that the normie is the roadblock to change. He's the one who's stopping change from happening. But really, he isn't really doing anything. He isn't actually having much negative or positive effect on society in politics, in political terms. He's just following the herd. He's just following whatever's fashionable. So he's not really a block. He's more neutral than that. He's sort of inert politically.
Yeah, I think that the conception of the normies, let's call it thick-headedness or refusal or inability more precisely to engage with the political, is a relict of our own egalitarianism. So even though we are distanced and we reject egalitarianism, right? This is why we are dissenting, because I think that the central metaphysical unquestionable truth of the current regime in power is that all men are created equal. And if you dissent from that, in whichever way, you are a dissident. But I think that because all of us grew up in this regime and had this hammered into our heads through education and propaganda and media and just the surrounding culture, I think we still deep down at the lizard brain level believe it. And we expect people to be like us, because what's the only picture you have of what a human mind looks like from the inside? It's your own mind. I think it's natural to assume that everyone else is wired the way you are. And it's a big leap of perception and of conviction to actually accept that other men might not think the way you think, and they might actually not be capable of thinking the same way you think. And I think that and I'm very guilty of this, and I should stop doing this. Just the other day, I posted a picture of sheep saying it's normies in their natural habitat. It's a relic of our egalitarian upbringing. It's like people who lose faith. You're still culturally Christian, right? Or you're culturally, yes, whatever you are. Well, we are still culturally or temperamentally egalitarian. We have not shorn it. We have not shed this residual egalitarianism. And this is why we have such disdain and such contempt for the normies. Even though he's not really in our way politically, our genuine enemy are the enemy elites, right?
Enemy elites. And of course, the normie never promised to be anything for us. That's the thing. So it's kind of irrational for us to be angry with him.
Well, there is the element of we are fighting for him, right? You know, so if we are white nationalists, we are fighting for the white normie. If we are of the distant right, and if the normie is, you know, not insane, not perverted in another way, you know, he's a heterosexual, he wants to engage in family formation, we are fighting for him, right? So there is a sense in which he owes us maybe, at the very least, gratitude for what we're trying to do, for trying to save him.
Yeah, and yet instead he gives us contempt and hatred. He loathes us. So, you know, this is
something natural. I hear from, you know, not just the broader global struggle, but the struggle here in Macedonia is, why are you fighting for these people when they obviously don't have the will to survive or to fight back? People will say to me, why are you wasting your time? And I don't really have a good answer to that, which doesn't sound... you actually have to stop believing in egalitarianism to give a valid answer to that, you know.
Well, So what is the valid answer then?
Because nobody else will.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And yeah. But I don't like it because it implies that I am the elite that will lead the normies to liberation. And this might be true, but I could be setting myself up for basically a fantasy of imagining myself as the gallant hero who will save and rescue the normies.
Yeah.
So you understand why it's problematic. Oh, but yeah. It is at the core of it, because I see this problem and I see my people will be eradicated if I do nothing. So I do these things that I do.
Yeah. And it's a very complex matter because there is a limit to how much you can take. I don't mean you specifically. I mean any one of us. There have been times when I have felt really I've given so much, and the normies continue to reward me with hatred and contempt. And I think there is a limit to how much any one of us can stand of that. But eventually, I can imagine someone saying, right, just fuck them. Just if they're not going to defend their own existence, if they're actually going to celebrate their own extinction, and then they're going to punish people like me who try to stand up for them, for their existence, then what is the point? I mean, that is a valid question, I think. But again, it rests on the egalitarian notion that you were saying earlier, of actually taking them seriously, where we really shouldn't. And we should expect them to pour contempt on us because that's what they're told to do. And it's not really that they are deciding to do that as such. They're not really sizing the situation up themselves. They're just following orders.
Yes. And there is, of course, this may be a controversial opinion, but I do think that the dissident right consists of disaffected elites. You take a survey of who our guys are, you know, what they do for a living, who their parents are, what's their position in life. You get a sense that these are second echelon elites or the sons of second and first echelon elites who don't like the current arrangement, mostly because they're going to probably lose out power in the next 10, 20 years because we're white, we're male, but also out of a sense of duty, out of a sense of noblesse oblige. And I use elite in the broader sense, not just of position in society, but in the sense of phenotype. I think that elite and plebeian or normie are biological categories first and foremost. I think that if we go by biological category, the dissident right is part of some of the layers of the elite, and even by position, we are disproportionately elite. So, I mean,
I think it's interesting just on that point. I do think that there are a lot of people in the dissident right who don't fit that description, and I think that there are a lot of very flawed people in the dissident right, myself included. But I would agree with you about the overall intelligence level being unusually high. And you can see this by comparing, for example, the YouTube comment thread under one of our channels with the YouTube comment thread under a centrist channel. And you see that there is a very marked difference. These people are supposedly our fellow travelers. They agree with us about the SJWs. They agree with us about egalitarianism, supposedly. But they don't like the anti-white stuff. You know, they want everyone to just forget about identity politics. So in a certain sense, they're our fellow travelers, and they support freedom of speech, which obviously benefits us. So in a certain sense, they're our fellow travelers, but in another sense, they're fucking thick. I can't put it any other way. You can see in the comments that they post that they are simply nowhere near as bright. It's like a standard deviation below the dissident right. And I don't say this as self-aggrandizement or whatever. I don't really care about that. There's not much, it wouldn't benefit us to be like that. I'm just stating it as a sort of objective fact that I use this as evidence that we are brighter than the average. However, I'm not sure if we're brighter than our opponents on the left, because, and this is where I disagree with a lot of people on our side, who they'll talk about the spiteful mutants and how the left are dysfunctional and mad and sociopathic and all that kind of stuff. And I really object to that, because I think there's a lot of sociopathy on the right. And I think that there are a lot of very functional people on the left. And I think there are a lot of very intelligent people on the left. And I don't just mean of a certain ethnic group. I mean, the Europeans as well. So I'm not sure about that. But I do think that there is a reason. I think that certain types of people are attracted into politics, and it tends to be the brighter people, put it that way.
Yeah, I'm going to partially agree with you there, Woz. I agree that there's a lot of sociopathy on the right, and particularly on the dissident right. And I invite everyone to listen back to the writer's block I did with Josh Neal. And also, if you want to, if you have the time, read an essay of mine on Countercurrents, the title is The Struggle is Real. And it is about what the psychologists would call the Thanatos instinct, the death instinct on the right, specifically as it is expressed in an urge for self-destruction. And of course, in American Extremist, Josh Neal says that this is often directed towards hatred of the other. So whereas a healthy dissident rightist would be concerned with the preservation of his people, with the maintenance of culture and social norms and order, sociopathic and pathological dissident rightists would be concerned with the destruction of outgroups. And I think we all know someone who's like that, who has to shake their fist at an outgroup at all times. And I just say, distance yourself from these people. Now, as to the left being, yes, there's a lot of intelligence on the left, but I learned something playing chess, that what really matters is the openings and the first part of the mid game. I want to do maybe an experiment one of these days, or maybe after we win and we have the resources of the state at our disposal, I'll conduct my experiment. Have a grandmaster perform the opening moves and half of the mid game, let's say up until move 15, and then hand the game over to a beginner. And the grandmaster will, of course, know he's handing the game over to a beginner. I suspect that beginner would be able to complete the game and defeat the opponent. So I think, let me just finish my metaphor here. What I think that the left has happened on the left is their fathers and grandfathers, from whom they inherited this power they now held, they are the grandmasters of my example. They set up the opening moves, they set up the mid game for them, and now all they have to do is play this position game against us. And it doesn't matter how tactically brilliant we may be. I think actually the dissident right is of higher IQ than the left. Maybe not by a large margin, but I think we are. But we are playing from a very weak starting position. And their ancestors in the actually set it up very well for them. We look at the contemporary left. You look at Joe Biden. He's a dementia patient. You look at, do you even have a prominent leftist left in the United Kingdom?
The people like Owen Jones, Laurie right. Penny, Ash Sarkar, and these people are simply not very intelligent.
Right. Remember that these people are the inheritors of such monstrous entities such as Franklin Delano Roosevelt and John Kennedy and Tony Blair, you know, the Dark Lord. So they inherit this position in mid-game from these Dark Lords, these evil geniuses. this FDR was a political genius. So is Tony Blair. Still, he's still alive. And so all they really have to do is finish this game, which has been set up for them. Whereas we come hot on the heels of, well, complete and utter defeat for the past 80 years, maybe more, maybe even more so. So we can cope and we can console ourselves that we are the smarter guys, but we're playing a rigged game, and we are. But the goal is to win. And more than IQ, I think that what sets apart Prol from Elite is will. You know, you could call it thumos. In the ancient Greeks called it thumos, and it's located in the chest. This is something Orwell commented about, that ours is an age of men without chests. And I think that the dissident right is the party of men with chests in the age of men without chests. Now, you can also have Plato discusses it in the Republic, in the opening of the Republic, an excess of chest, an excess of thumos. But, and we, of course, all of the pathologies and dysfunction of the dissident right are pathologies of excess thumos.
Yes, indeed. It's like there are too many chiefs, not enough Indians.
which is a serious problem. You could even call it elite overproduction if you want to sound fancy. I want to take a better look at this phenomenon. I think Peter Turchin does not do it justice, even though he coined the term.
Right. I mean, you see, the way I have seen this up until now is that the right has a lot of disagreeable. You know, Jordan Peterson, bless his heart, talks about trait agreeableness. And he says that the left, women and the left are very high in this trait, which is that they are conformist, they go for consensus building, and they follow the herd, they follow what's fashionable. And I think in the distant right, we have a serious deficit of such people, because everyone seems to think that they know how to win. And you know, sometimes this is what I mentioned when I mentioned sociopathy earlier. I said there's a lot of sociopathy on the right. This is the kind of thing that I mean, where people will disagree with each other to the point where there'll be purity spirals and sabotaging each other, things like that, just because they disagree on some point. And they'll actually forget about all the things that they have in common, the goals that they share. And basically, I just mean it's like herding cats. You know, trying to get the right to behind something is like herding cats. What would you say about that?
Herding cats. Before I comment on agreeableness, I'm not sure it's a useful parameter. No, agreeable. I mean, I know what it's meant by it. I know what Jordan Peterson means by it. But Kevin MacDonald has an alternative hypothesis on human personality, claiming that the two aspects of agreeableness, I think the first is sociability and the second eludes me, because the data by gender, by sex, does not comport with the existence of this parameter, agreeableness, that we should rethink the big five personality traits. Specifically, he talks about rotating it by 90 degrees, so that way the measurements will comport to the data we have by gender. And of course, you know, you hear this, men are more or less agreeable than women, women are more agreeable than men. But men are more agreeable, you know, in the parameter which matters, which in forming bonds and actualizing these bonds. You know, the Mannerbund is a product of the male aspect of agreeableness, whereas the female aspect of agreeableness is more about agreeing with, not, you know, agreeing with diktats from above rather than with the peer group. So women rarely agree with peers, but they obey authority, and the left obeys authority, and the right is supposed to be disagreeable, but it obeys because it obeys authority. But the right is the ones with the stronger social bonds. you know, because we are, you could call it horizontally agreeable. We should really ask Dr. Kevin MacDonald to expand this theory of personality. But I will say that the dissident right, I think that the problem could be that, but it is ultimately an excess of chest. It's an excess of chest. I think everyone wants to be top dog.
Yeah.
It's like you said, too many chiefs, not enough Indians. But we are seeing in later years maybe you could call it a harrowing of the chiefs. And Greg has talked about this. People looking in, they say fewer people as content creators and thought leaders, and they think the movement is shrinking. But he, as a thought leader and content creator, is on the stage looking at the audience, and he can actually see the audience growing. And so we may be making progress in that direction. There is a culling of the chiefs and a gathering of the Indians.
Right. I guess that his experience won't be colored by getting deplatformed from YouTube or Twitter, because his primary thing was always the Countercurrents website. So he can compare like with like. Whereas for someone like me, obviously, you know, I lost YouTube, and there simply aren't as many people on Odyssey or BitChute as there are on YouTube. So it's very difficult to compare what's going on now with the situation 2 years ago. So I can see, I hope that Greg is correct about that. I'm sure that his numbers must be correct. I suppose then another issue would be, and this is how I've always, I've seen this for some time, is that I think that men obey hierarchy structures. And when there is a structure in place, men are very good at finding their place in it and actually obeying this, serving the structure. So like a military organization, for example. And I think that this was what has always been missing from the movement. There is no formal structure. There is no formal hierarchy. And so it's very easy for someone to just come along. There was a case about a year ago where a guy joined the movement and very quickly was behaving as if he'd been around for years, and he was trying to undermine other people who had been around for years. And he knew nothing. He was an imbecile, but he was an egomaniac, and he was able to do this because he had charisma. And I guess that's a problem, because there is no formal hierarchy, no formal structure in place, that there is instead a sort of chaotic scrabble to be on top. As you said, everyone wants to be in charge. I mean, it's a natural thing to, you know, want to be the alpha. And I think this is why organizations like the military make the structure very, very explicit, so that everyone knows not to mess around.
Yeah. The tragedy of it is, though, as you were describing the nobody, the imbecile who joined last year and started behaving like he's a leader and became wildly popular, I could think of several people.
Yeah,
like
I don't
that.
Want to name names. There's
yeah,
no
you
know,
if unless
the general principle is the point.
Unless you name him, I won't know who it is, because there's several people like that. That's tragic. So you were talking about losing your YouTube, and you lost X number of people, but were they ever yours to begin with? Because I know for a fact that a couple of people you would consider normies used to listen to you. You know, I know them in real life. They used to listen to you while they're, you know, playing video games or when they're vegging out, because, your voice is soothing, your accent is amusing, or things like this. I mean, I listen to people because of these things, right? I also try to seek out people to listen to because I want to learn. I want to compare ideas with them. But if someone has a soothing voice, if someone has an amusing accent, I'm likelier to listen to them because I like these things too. So the question is, How many of the people you lost when you lost your YouTube and Twitter channel were ever, quote unquote, yours to begin with? Well, were they just, peripheral participants? And isn't this shrinking merely a boiling off of the peripheral participants?
Undoubtedly, that will be part of it. But I think another part of it is simply that human nature, the pleasure principle, people are fundamentally quite lazy. And I'm the same. I didn't join Odyssey until I got banned from YouTube. I can't remember now. But I think I did have it for about a month before. But that was only sort of coincidental. And so I understand even people who are really committed and in the movement and all of that, even they ultimately will take the easy option of staying on YouTube. I think it's both, though. I think you are right that a lot of them are peripheral people. My channel would have been one of many that they listened to sporadically when they just needed some accompaniment for a marathon gaming session. So it is kind of strange. But of course, that is part of how the movement grew. It's part of how we, on the mainstream, it was part of how we attracted people, but just by accident, really. They would find us, and then they would start listening quite regularly. And that's what is no longer possible. And so we have to adapt to that, which is a very difficult thing because it means operating in a different way. So you don't want to just be preaching to the converted and telling and endlessly saying what everyone already knows, because that's just depressing. But at the same time, you can't approach it as if we're influencing the mainstream anymore, because I don't think we are. I really don't want to be black-pilled about this. I'm just trying to be realistic. But what do you think about that? Do you think that we are still able to influence the mainstream?
We are influencing the mainstream, but we are doing it on the mainstream's terms. That's the problem. We are not dictating terms to the mainstream. They are using us. It's more apt to say that they are using us as a scarecrow with which to motivate their own, or scare the blacks into compliance or whatever. We are Farmer Jones. Farmer Jones had influence on Animal Farm as a scarecrow, as a boogeyman.
I first noticed this when the term alt-right began to. I realized it no longer belonged to us, and we were no longer able to define it. It now belonged to the mainstream media, and they were able to define it because they simply had more power than we had. So they were able to assert that alt-right means, whatever the worst stuff in the world.
It means people we don't like.
Yeah, yeah. So they hate women, they hate black people, they hate Muslims, and they want to just kill them all. Genocide. It was just insane stuff that was being associated with that label, because we no longer had control over it. And that was an interesting and unnerving moment for me when I realized that we no longer had control of that label. So
realize that?
Around the time of Charlottesville. So like August 2017, but really it was probably before that, even before that, I think. Throughout 2017, I think we were gradually losing control of it, because they were simply using it all the time, and they were associating it with whatever they want. I mean, even Alex Jones. I remember I got interviewed by a Washington Post journalist, and he thought that Alex Jones was the alt-right, because that's what he had read in other mainstream media articles. And conspiracy theorists, UFOs, all of that kind of stuff. It was all, that's the alt-right. I had to put him right about it. And I had to say, no, that's not. And people like Milo, that's not what the term means. And I guess the relative, I mean, obviously this is of historical interest, but it's not really important. The principle is important.
It is important in the sense that we can actually track the way in which the mainstream assimilates a tax on itself. See, that's maybe, maybe we can draw parallels to the way in which just the Ron Paul phenomenon was deflected away as a threat to the mainstream. I remember in 2008 and 2012, there was great energy for Ron Paul. But by 2014, 15, you had people calling themselves libertarians and calling for universal basic income in the same sentence. And by 2015, it was just Jeffrey Tucker soyjacking over mozzarella sticks before the soyjack was invented as a cultural archetype. It was the libertarian moment in 2008 and 12. You had the Tea Party. You had everyone and their mother understand Austrian economics. It's the business cycle, man. It's inflation. We got to audit the Fed. And then by 2014, this term and the entire idea space is completely absorbed by the mainstream. And you have these women of middling attractiveness, like what's her name, Kennedy, dancing on Fox News and saying that supporting butt sex is libertarian, which it is. But the Ron Paul movement was very different from that. And I think something similar happened to us. Maybe the battle was already lost when Milo started calling himself alt-right.
That was in mid-2016, if I recall correctly.
Right, right.
Before the election.
I think that the moment where I said, put a stick in it, put a fork in it, it's done, like the Americans say, was when I was watching the Punisher series on, it's from the Marvel Cinematic Universe. A friend of mine recommended it to me. I said, no, it's cape shit. He said, no, it's good. And I watched it. And in the second season, they tried to pass off these evangelicons as quote unquote alt-right. So, okay. If you're portraying the evangelical and corporate right as alt-right, fuck it. The term is completely out of our hands. It's completely past logic now. I mean, it literally meant alternative right. Alternative to what? The mainstream right, which is evangelicals and corporate right.
Yeah, so absolutely.
If the mainstream right is alt-right, yeah, this is a useless term now.
Yeah, and I think it then became associated with white supremacy. Of course, no one ever really defines that, but we know that it's really bad. Whatever white supremacy is, it's really, really bad. And it got associated with terrorism. And it doesn't matter that association was erroneous, manufactured. It simply, all that matters is that the association was established. And this is why nowadays, I think that all that really matters is power. And I've been saying this on my own show quite a lot this year, that really we should expect this kind of trickery as long as we are not the ones with the power. You know, as long as our enemies, our opponents are the ones with the power, they're going to just do this. They're just going to play with us like a cat plays with a mouse before it slaughters it.
I think I agree with that. I think that without power, well, we just say power, but we don't really understand the phenomenon. We don't really know how to generate it.
Yeah. For the sake of clarity, let me say, when I say power, I don't mean white power out on the streets terrorizing non-whites and whatever, right? That's absolutely not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about real institutional power and money, wealth. What our opponents have. Now, the question for me is, can we possibly amass that? And can we amass it in time to save, what we call Western civilization, or not? And should we just be working behind the scenes, encouraging people to amass this quietly, in a stealth manner, so that when things do collapse, they can take charge. But of course, that rests on the assumption that things are going to fall apart, that there is going to be a collapse. It's all very complex.
Even if there is a collapse, it's not guaranteed that it's us who are going to take power. I was thinking about this. I was thinking about our friends in the neo-reactionary sphere, and they are also waiting for a collapse, and they're also preparing to seize power. But first of all, their plans are more realistic and easier to achieve, because the power shift they intend on seeing through is... I'm going to use a Soviet metaphor here, Gorbachev to Yeltsin. So at the end of the Soviet Union, when the Soviet Union collapsed, power shifted from the Soviet Union, from the Union of Soviet Socialist Republic headed by Mikhail Gorbachev, to the Russian Federation, right, which was headed by Boris Yeltsin, and of course all of the various Soviet states. But if you look at their leaders, they're all Soviet apparatchiks. You have Yeltsin in Russia, you have Shevardnadze in Georgia, you have Nursultan Nazarbayev in Kazakhstan, you have the guy who later started calling himself Turkmenbashi in Turkmenistan. And what do all these people have in common? They're all Communist Party functionaries. And what I see neo-reactionaries and Bronze Age pervert trying to effectuate is bring forth American Yeltsin with a hope that one day maybe he evolves into American Putin. Now, whether Putin is a good leader, a traditional leader, that's 5 hours of conversation in of itself. But our goal as the nationalist and traditionalist right is not to swap out Gorbachev with Yeltsin. It's to swap out Gorbachev with Solzhenitsyn. Right, or maybe even the Tsar, and that's a far bigger ask than, because that's the thing. It's like, oh, elites will be replaced by elites, but is it the same category of elite? We can agree that Gorbachev and Yeltsin and the Tsar and Solzhenitsyn are all elites, but there's a world of difference between them, and I don't know. I know enough about contemporary Russia, and especially about Russia in the 90s, to know that we should not be rooting for Yeltsin, even if, you know, there was a Putin behind him. Because as people in Russia are fond of pointing out, it's not the global homo West flooding Moscow with Uzbeks and Tajiks and Kyrgyzs and whatever. It's Vlad Vladimirovich Putin. And are we sure we want that? We are the guys, we are actually playing the game on the hardest difficulties. We are putting people far more depraved and far more communist than Mikhail Gorbachev. We're taking them and we're trying to replace them with someone far more traditional and far more based than Tsar Nikolai II. And I cannot even imagine the kind of power that would be necessary to effectuate such a massive change. However, I'm not sure this is even conceivable by a single man. Dune is now in the news because they made the whole is it a movie or is it a series? I'm not sure. The Denis Villeneuve film.
Yeah.
Well, no single Bene Gesserit actually knows about the Kvizatz Haderach project, right? No one member of that holy order knows about the whole project. So I'm not sure that you and I, as individual members of the dissident right, can even conceive of the machinations of this whole movement. But I'm sure it can be done. I wouldn't be playing this game if it were unwinnable.
Well, that's I guess that's a white pill. what do you think about the prospect of a system collapse, civilizational collapse? I mean, is that because obviously a lot of people sort of rest on that. And I've certainly done this myself at various points in the past, where you think the only thing that can bring this about is if everything falls apart. And we do seem to be in something, and there are signs that we are heading towards that, things falling apart. So I'll believe that that is going to happen. So what would you say is that wishful thinking?
Are we talking about the economic aspect of things?
Yes, but also cultural. I mean, how long can this go on? You know, the birth rates going down, the numbers of white people in each country going, the percentage going down all the time, morals, public morals, just seem to be coarsening and worsening all the time. So I wonder how long this can go on for.
That's a very good question. I think that the system, our enemy system, their economic, political, military, security, cultural, et cetera, system, relies on the labor of a specific kind of man to survive. And we are talking about men here. Women are a negative drag on these systems in all cases. Sorry, women, you're not system people. You are house and garden people. And the vast majority of this, the men of this type necessary, so IQ above 108, a certain degree of psychological stability, a certain ability to think outside the box flexibly, fix problems on the spot. And no white guilt spoke about this, that back in the day when you had white architects making plans and white foremen of construction crews implementing them, what the foreman would do is modify the plans slightly so that they better fit the ground on which the building is constructed. Whereas now you have non-white foremen. It's still white architects, but it's non-white foremen. And they just implement without thinking, without making these minor adjustments to the architect's plans. And then that's why modern buildings are such crap. One of the many reasons, actually. It's basically the paucity of white men. It's a very specific type of man. It's a behavioral type, not a racial type. You can find Asian, Indian, Jewish, black men who are like this, who are capable of keeping these systems afloat. But without white men, you're not. It's just the overwhelming majority will be just white guys doing this. You look at the people building Elon Musk's rockets. They're all white. Not one of them. You know, I don't think there is one Asian on that team even. And we're going to see a worsening of the system because it can magic money into being. It has the world's resources at its fingertips. But it turns out that personnel is tough to get because, hey, you need white men and your political loyalty generation engine is predicated on hatred, denigration, and humiliation of white men. So that could be the source of the collapse. But I'm not seeing the economic makings of collapse. I'm seeing the economic makings of shortages. I'm seeing the economic makings of mismanagement. And if we're going to mention the Soviet Union again, it was near starvation levels before things started to move towards the direction of collapse in the political sense. And even then it was replaced with Yeltsin and not with the Tsar or Solzhenitsyn. So there's a lot of ruin in a nation, as Adam Smith says. Yeah, there's going to be a slowdown, economic slowdown, legal slowdown, slowdown in every sense. It's going to be possibly dragged out over a century. And there's a lot of ruin in the West. The West is very wealthy. It's an old civilization. There's a lot of culture to deconstruct. There's a lot of morals to emcrassen, if I can, you know, just coin the word on the spot because I cannot think of a better one. Yep.
And
it's not going to be, there's not going to be a bang. It will be a long 100-year whimper if there is going to be a collapse. Think of Rome. It was steadily collapsing since the end of maybe the Flavian dynasty. And even then, Byzantium lingered on. After the conquests of Justinian and Belisarius, Byzantium lingered on for 700 years. So yes. There's a lot of ruin in a civilization.
Yeah, more than in a nation. What would you say about the Great Reset? You know, what we hear about now, the plans of Klaus Schwab and so on for the Fourth Industrial Revolution. Do you think that is a pipe dream? Do you think it's sort of the wankery of high echelon people, dreamers, or do you think it's going to be something real and important?
It is definitely wankery. You know, it's rank wankery. It's high octane wankery. You know, there's a lot of lube went into that wankery. But the problem is the wankery of powerful people often gets made into reality. And especially if they, as are powerful people, are surrounded by sycophants, some people who will not or cannot tell them that what they're doing is wankery. From what I can tell, the great recent reset plans, they're probably going to be very difficult to implement without significant pushback, even from the much scorned normies. I don't know how significant this pushback is going to be. You know about the Chinese social credit system, right?
Oh, yes.
I was reading something this afternoon, specifically on the difficulties the Chinese have in implementing this system. Like, it's not smooth. The Chinese are always cheating. They're lying. So they have found out ways to trick the cameras. So the Chinese state has to employ snitches, but you know, they get discovered and the wool gets pulled over their eyes. And you're thinking, if people as obedient as the Chinese are resisting this, well, very mild aspect, comparatively mild aspect of the Great Reset, the social credit stuff is mild compared to the other stuff. What do you think is going to happen to white people when you try this on white people? We are seeing the reaction in Australia, right? You have trucker strikes, you have construction worker strikes. And again, it's you cannot have a civilization without truckers, construction workers, and cops. I see that police unions in many places are refusing vaccine mandates. This is a positive development. I think you're going to have so much pushback that this is just going to become untenable. It's going to be put on the back burner. Bear in mind, I don't think this is the first time they have tried something like this. I think they had these doomsday ecological cults in the 80s as well. Child prophets like Greta Thunberg saying that, oh, how dare you? You're going to kill the polar bears. I'm sorry. I did not mean to do that. It's racist to Swedish people, I guess. And this is not new. And every time they had to dial it back due to pushback, but they got an inch. And if this is a centuries long play, they can take us inch by inch. They can take over the situation. It's just that it's just so contrary to human nature. You know, it's one thing to tell people, oh, you're going to now have social credit. We are already used to that. You have social credit, it's just not formal. But it's just another thing to live in a pod, eat bugs, never own a vehicle anymore, never. You're going to be less free than not even a medieval serf. You're going to be less free than a Negro slave in the South, and you're going to like it. I don't think they can sell that to enough people. I don't think they can sell that to the second echelon elites. I don't think they can sell that to the Yeltsins of the world. You're already seeing pushback from political and business leaders in various countries around the world against this. So I'm just not sure of its applicability.
Feasibility. Yeah, well, I hope you're right. I mean, there are these rebellions just now in Australia, and I did see about the police department in, I think it was Chicago, that there was somewhere that had 2,000 police officers, and they were struggling to keep it above that number because police officers kept resigning. And then the truckers, of course. Ironically, that is how this would fail. It would be people on the ground just refusing to go along with it. And I guess the system has up till now managed to thwart this by just keeping the incentives to conform very high. Like, you want to keep your job? Well, you're going to have to get vaccinated. And enough people are fearful when they hear that they go along and get vaccinated. So I guess that would be the question, really, is because obviously all of this relies on continued comfort. And I think that's what people are terrified of losing, understandably, because we are accustomed to a very high level of comfort. And I think that to tell people, well, you can either have freedom or you can have comfort, that's not going to make the impression on the normie mind that you might hope for. You know, I think a lot of them will say, well, I want the comfort. But I hope that you are right and that they'll say, okay, if that's what's necessary, then I'll make that sacrifice because I do believe in freedom and dignity.
The vax in particular, I think, is the deal breaker. I mean, people were saying in 2019, you will live in the pod. You already live in a pod. You know, if you live in an apartment and not a house, you live in a sort of pod, and a house is a sort of pod too, right? But I think that the vax is the deal breaker because the vaccine introduces an absorbing barrier in the cost benefit and benefit analysis. It's because the vax comes with a 2% chance of something very serious happening either to you, you know, with you either die, there is a chance you could become infertile or you could disrupt your fertility, right? I know someone, a female, who took the vaccine and had two periods in as many weeks and paralysis on her leg. So it didn't kill her, but it's very nasty, even if it doesn't kill you, right? So I think that the introduction of this element is then the decision-making process is shifted from the forebrain to the hindbrain, to the lizard brain. And the lizard brain is really good at sniffing out these life and death type situations. It can do, you know, stochastic analysis far better than you can do with your forebrain, because it's evolved to do that. It's evolved to calculate payoffs and probabilities of survival. And it's very prone to type 1 errors, you know, not taking chances. And this is one of these, even if we're wrong about the vaccine, is a type 1 error. It's the kind of error you can make and live. And I think that's been proven beyond a doubt, that you're at no risk of dying if you don't take the vaccine. But there is a non-insignificant risk of dying, injury, and very importantly, infertility if you take the vaccine. So at this point, you know, even a normie, because they are still biological beings, they're still governed by the logic of biological beings, they will, I think, ultimately refuse the vax. And I think that the people who will take the vax are those of middling intelligence who can override their instincts with brain power, but lack the brain power to think this through. And of course, people who are so alienated from their surroundings and their tradition that they don't know that it's better to believe, to trust your gut and to trust your instincts on these things. Like, the more experience I attain, you know, the more I realize two things. One, my grandma was right about most things. Two, my gut is right about most things. Your gut and your grandma, that's all you really need in life to survive. Everything else takes a brain, but survival, you can do that with your gut and your grandma.
This is the midwit meme, where you've got the sort of thick redneck who believes what he sees. I believe what I see. And then at the other end, the far end, you've got this professor who says, yes, I'm very careful about what I believe, and empirical truth, empirical experience is just as important as scientific data. And then in the middle, you've got the soy boy, the idiot who is flattering himself with his own intelligence, that thank God he's not that redneck who just believes what he sees. The midwit is intelligent enough to understand that data matters and science tells us the truth. Science gives us insight. And he's sort of in love with it. He's been flattered into believing what the powerful want him to believe. And I find the midwit, I've got many variants of the midwit meme because it's so funny, because it's so true. Because time and again, on one issue after another, you've got the midwits believing this is something that's so stupid, but you would need to have a certain IQ level to believe it. Like, for example, that there are no races. Race is just an imagined fiction. And there is no such thing as male and female. You know, these crazy things. An imbecile wouldn't believe them. And a very, very thoughtful, self-aware person wouldn't believe them. But the midwit does. The midwit falls for them hook, line, and sinker every single time. I find that fascinating, actually. I find that a very interesting social phenomenon, that it's the midwits who are the most gullible, because you can flatter them. You can flatter them and say, well, I know you're bright. I know you've got a degree. So I know you'll believe the hard academic truth here. And then that just gets them, you know, they're completely seduced by that, and they forget all about being careful. It's really interesting to me. I guess because I've known so many people like that in my life, it really fits. I mean, so many people that I used to know,
you didn't go to art school. That's where society collectively dumps its midwits.
Yes, obviously.
Except Uncle Adolf.
Yeah, right. Well, and me, hopefully. Yeah. But yeah, the midwits, you see, back then, that was 20 years ago. And at that point, and this is something that's very interesting, it sort of gets us onto a different topic, I guess. Back then, the thing at art college was that everyone was apolitical, even feminism. You know, it wasn't a thing. It really, and it was seen as naff. It was seen as something from 20, 30 years ago, which it was. And everyone was apolitical because they all thought they're too clever for politics. Politics is for boring people. We are rebels and we are clever. We're intelligent. So we don't get in. We don't care about things like that. And it's interesting to contrast that with nowadays, 20 years later. I can't even begin to imagine how politicized the average art college must be. You know, the lectures are, and obviously even then there was, of course, there was a hard left underpinning to the lectures. And I actually know that quite a few of my lecturers were card-carrying communists. I discovered that afterwards. And you know, the general feel of what they were teaching, it was certainly not conservative. It was leftist, but it wasn't explicit. And certainly the atmosphere around the college was not political. You didn't get posters for political rallies or communists or anything like that. But I'm guessing that nowadays that's pretty much a prerequisite, that you are of explicitly left-wing politics before you'll even be allowed to cross the threshold. And also the other thing, and this is relates to the midwit thing, politics has now been down, it's been dirtied down. It's been degraded to LGBT, rainbow flag, BLM, just crass slogans, so that anyone can, like the midwit, can take part in it. And even below the midwit can take part in it. So there really isn't, it's not something that's difficult anyway. You don't really need to have read a single book in order to understand the BLM cause. And to be honest, it's probably better that you haven't read a single book in order to understand it. And so it's now something that's everywhere. Everything now is political, and that is a change from 20 years ago. And I think this relates to it's a fascinating subject that culture seems to have stood still. Certain facets of culture have just stood completely still for at least 20 years, like 20, 25 years at this point. Fashion has not changed, like the clothes that people wear, the hairstyles, interior decorating, the styles of cars, the styles of music. All of this stuff has stood completely still since the year 2000. But culturally, society actually has changed a great deal in that time. And this is an interesting contrast, a sort of dichotomy, because in that time, very key ideas have changed about authority, responsibility, civic duty, obviously race, sex, in both senses of the word sex. These key things have changed, but the changes have gone entirely unexamined at the level of culture, music, art, literature. It just hasn't happened. There's been no examination whatsoever of these changes.
Part of it, I think, is because, as you mentioned, 20 years ago, art college was non-political, right? And all sorts of colleges were apolitical. Man, I don't deal in politics. That does not interest me. This was the cool thing to say, right? But the general atmosphere was left wing, and people were encouraged to engage in activities which naturally drive them towards the left. So what was the big thing with the big cultural artifact of the 90s, you could say, which in retrospect has had such an immense influence on our civilization as it is? Sex and the City, right? And grunge music. What do these bring with themselves? Promiscuity from Sex and the City, drug use from grunge music. I like grunge music, but let's face fact, it glorifies drug use without the baggage of the hippy dippy crap. It actually makes it post-ironically cool, or ironically cool, to do drugs, even though you know they're bad for you. So, and once you're a promiscuous woman or a guy doing drugs, even if it's just weed, and man, you're apolitical, but you're going to be hurled into the political with these positions you already hold. And as a woman, you will have to defend promiscuity and everything that implies, you know, contraception, abortion, marriage laws. I did a whole stream with F. Roger Devlin, and he was also recently on Ed Dutton's show discussing sexual utopian power. So all of the implications of female promiscuity and female sexual incontinence, everything that comes from that puts you on the left. So if you support that as a woman who is sexually promiscuous, or as a man availing himself of sexually promiscuous women, you're going to be put in a position where you're going to have to defend the left. You're going to have to defend abortion, contraception on demand, erosion of the family unit, punitive divorce laws for men, and everything. If you're put in the position of, oh, you're just a guy smoking weed, then what the left can do is create this paranoia in you that, oh man, those evil right wingers are out to get you. And if you've ever been, you know, shaken down by a cop looking for weed, which he should, because it is a controlled substance, you know, you're going to feel persecuted. You're going to have this persecution mania, which the left can then weaponize. So yeah, you smoke weed non-politically, but when you know, push comes to shove and things become political, because of this position you've taken apolitically to be one of the cool kids who has promiscuous sex and smokes weed, you find yourself defending the left. Even if you're not a prolific weed smoker, you just like Bob Marley. And this is why he's so, people are saying endlessly, oh, he's one of the greatest musicians, Bob Marley this, Bob Marley that. I like some Bob Marley music, but he's nothing to write, you know, home about. One of the this is the reason, from this apolitical position, you find yourself painted into a corner where all you can really do is be a leftist, at first defensively, because you want to go on being promiscuous or availing yourself of promiscuity. You want to go on smoking weed and belonging to that culture, you know, stoner culture. They make it out like it's a culture. It's I love that meme. If cigarette smokers were like weed smokers, and the guy just comes in with the Marlboro shirt and the Marlboro pendant, and he's listening to, you know, I don't know, some famous country singer who smokes Marlboros and is, you know, he makes music about smoking Marlboros and how it makes him very tough and cool. And I don't know. It's that's how they got the change to be unexamined. By the moment the time for choosing came, you had already made the decision constitutionally. The change was unexamined. The formal change was unexamined because you were already promiscuous or a drug user or whatever leftist cause celebrity it was, homosexuality, transgenderism, this, that, before these decisions were even on the horizon, you could say. You were already painted into the corner the left wanted for you. So yeah. I guess that's the way they get you. They get you through the culture. They get you to be promiscuous, painted as apolitical, and then 20 years later, promiscuity is, I think that the question of female misbehavior is one of the greatest political questions of our time, because what is everyone complaining about all the time? The birth rates, the white birth rates. Why aren't we having any babies? Because white women have not been oriented towards family creation. They've been oriented towards promiscuity. And this is very old. This is not recent. This is from the 90s, maybe from the 80s even.
Yeah, I mean, not to simp for the women, but I think that this is also on the men. We have also been conditioned to want the same thing. I mean, I know so many guys who just have no intention. It's alien to them. The idea of settling down is just alien to them. In their 30s and even their 40s. So I don't think it's just the women. You could say that the women encourage that attitude by rewarding it with promiscuous sex, but then it's the men who are asking for it. So, you know, this is something where I think really the men
avail themselves of it. It's really, look, men are going to have sex with women. It's either going to happen within the confines of marriage or outside of it. We know which is but you know, sex is going to transpire. It's not something that we should not expect men to be monks unless they actually are monks. Unless you've taken vows with a monastery, I don't think this is expected of men. And our ancestors knew this. They knew that men have urges. They will avail themselves of loose women nearby. The problem is not men's urges. The problem is the hyperabundance of loose women.
Yeah. I think it's just because, you know, you could say that men should be punishing loose women then, but they're not. You know, I do understand, though, that women are the sort of the gatekeepers of all this. I do understand that. I just think that ultimately the responsibility has to be borne by both sexes, because both sexes have been corrupted here. I mean, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, the idea of being, you know, the lad about town who's having sex with lots of different women, that would have been disgusting to most people. Whereas now it's definitely something that's recommended. It's definitely
been maybe so disgusting, but I think someone pointed out, maybe it was Z-Man, the girl's fathers would have gathered and kicked the shit out of him. It's
yes.
So if there is a failure on the part of men, there's a failure on the part of fathers. You know, you do not keep your daughters locked up or as some variation thereof. You do not find mates for them. You know, maybe the mothers, the grandmothers are not playing matchmaker strongly enough. And of course, this is all a question of people are being told that, oh, no matter what you do, she's going to run away. She's going to have sex either way. So you might as well accept it. Whereas tradition will say she's going to have sex either way. So best she does it within the confines of marriage. So it's a subtle difference, but a very big one. But we are seeing that it's not even a failure on the father's part. We know from Rotherham that the fathers tried to kick the shit out of the predatory men, and the police just arrested the fathers.
Well, that was one particular case where that happened, and he wasn't trying to kick the shit out of them. He was trying to rescue his daughter from the house, and he did it. He called the police.
You know, he would have had to throw fists with the kidnappers.
I've got to be very careful for legal reasons what I say and what I go along with here, okay? So just don't add that. Just be careful what you say about violence. What actually happened in that case was he was outside the house and he called the police and they arrived and they arrested him. So, but the moment for men to have agency on this in the way that you're talking about was 100 years ago. You know, at this point it would be insane for men to try to take charge, because the weight of the British state would just come down on them like a ton of bricks. So that option's completely off the table. It's got to this situation. But what they could do is just, you know, I can't even say that. You've got to remember, Britain is basically a police state when it comes to these issues. So I've got to be careful. But Neighbourhood Watch, and that was actually launched in certain northern towns a couple of years ago. I don't know how successful it was. But I see the thing is, I would expect even that to be cast as a racist project and to be clamped down on. So, I mean, that's how dystopian this society is.
I'm just amazed that we're not allowed to discuss the thing we're not allowed to discuss for legal reasons. I mean,
it's not that we're not allowed to discuss it. And I'm sorry if I shouted there. I just wanted to prevent you from saying something that could then be used against me. It's
I'm sorry. I'm really sorry about that, Woz. It's I keep forgetting that some of us live in hostile totalitarian third world dictatorships, such as the United Kingdom. Yeah, I'm saying this from Macedonia, which is Europe's third poorest country.
No, I mean, you didn't say anything terrible. Don't worry. Where were we? I forgot. Oh yeah, so men, fathers. Yeah, absolutely. And in a better world, they would be very careful about this kind of thing. But again, I think that, as you said, they were inveigled into just taking a back seat with what their daughters did. So. And that was done over 50, 60, 70 years. But yeah, at this point, there is a sort of ethnic dimension to it as well, where a father would be very scared of saying that, you know, to his daughter, you can't go with that boy, that man. Because if he did say that, he would risk that man bringing his, you know, five cousins and five brothers around to the house to sort him out. I mean, it's insane. You know, really, the only thing you could do is just get away, just move away. And of course, that's what white people do. White flight is a phenomenon everywhere.
Yeah, you can move away, but you're still sending your daughter and your son to college for brainwashing, for contact with diversity. And I think that more than the fear of that man and his five cousins showing up at the house, it's the fear of being called racist. I was talking to some Brazilians, it was some time ago, about whether Jair Bolsonaro, the president of Brazil, would do what Trump lacked the courage to do and remain in power. And one guy, he was very compelling that, no, Bolsonaro is not going to do shit. Why? Because he suffers from grandpa, are you a fascist syndrome, which is apparently endemic among the Latin American elite. Whenever they try to do something right-wing, something to promote order, something to fight back against global homo, their daughters, their granddaughters, they ask him, Grandpa, are you a fascist? I heard it on the American television that you are un fascista. And of course, even the most, stone cold caudillo cannot withstand this kind of assault from being called racist, which is our civilization's equivalent of Satanist or witch, by his granddaughter, right? You know, imagine the cutest 8-year-old girl, she's pure-blooded Spanish nobility, probably descended from King Ferdinand or, Rodrigo de Vivar, asking her abuelo, the dictator of Uruguay or whatever, abuelo, are you a fascist? And what is he supposed to say? Yes? Because that's what he has to say. Predictably, I think Bolsonaro did nothing because this guy had him pegged. So I think that it's not even that you're afraid of five guys kicking your ass. I can understand being afraid of 50 guys beating you up. But I think this is like fear of being called racist. If I tell my daughter not to date that black or that Muslim or that whatever, she's going to think I'm a racist. And what's a racist in the context of our civilization? What Satanist or witch would have been to a medieval peasant?
Well, I mean, when we're talking about white working class guys in the north of England, they're not so afraid of being called names. It's a different situation from
it's not even names. I don't think it's names. I don't think a medieval peasant would have cared if you called him shit mouth or whatever, but he would have cared about being called a Satanist by his own children, by his own grandchildren. So it's not even an insult. It yanks away at your familial and morality. It's really using your virtue against you. We all want to be good people. We have to account for ourselves before our conscience. And we know from the Bible that, children carry within themselves. They are purer than adults. Jesus said so himself. So when a child asks you, are you a racist? Which is not just any word. It's the worst epithet you can get as a white Westerner.
Yeah,
I think it crumbles even the hardest men, like I said, stone cold Latin American caudillos, North British hard cases. The North FC meme guy. I don't think he likes being called racist, especially by his granddaughter. Mm. That's
it will be a factor. There's a question come in here. Hold on a second. Oh, yeah. You implied that the reason for low reproduction rate of whites has to do with low morality. I think I said that. I didn't know. Well, hold on a minute. It's much more convoluted than that.
But it is actually a good summary of it.
Yeah.
I would open with that, not close with it, but it's a good way of putting it.
And then he goes on, have you considered a lot of it has to do with economic aspects, specifically global financial system exploiting economies and sucking the blood out of white middle class via taxation, money printing and inflation? Yeah, of course. But I also think that a large part of this is the culture. The culture has been shaped to discourage family formation, to discourage that urge. See, I remember when I was 22, something, maybe 23. I think it was like 21. I suddenly had this urge to start a family, to be a father, and I'd never felt it before in my life. And suddenly, at that age, it appeared, and I think that was probably quite typical. I suspect that at some point in a guy's 20s, he suddenly feels that urge, that very natural, it must be a natural urge to, okay, now I'll do that now. I want to have a wife. I want to have children. I want to settle down. But then other things might get in the way, or they might not. Traditionally speaking, our culture made sure that things didn't get in the way of that. But in our culture, I think that there were loads of things that got in the way of it and said, no, don't, just ignore that urge. You're too young. You're still 22, 20, whatever. Don't do it. And I think that probably loads of people feel that, young men especially, that it's our culture does not reward. And you see this. I mean, I remember in the 90s, that's as far back as my memory goes, really, as the 90s. You'll probably be the same, Nick. I remember in the 90s, like women's magazines would have things on the front cover. It would say tips about getting pregnant, tips about motherhood, tips about baby rearing or whatever, what to do with your child and all this kind of stuff. But you never see that now. I mean, like, if you're brave enough to look at, you know, the covers of women's magazines in supermarkets now, it's not about motherhood or being a good wife or being a, you know, finding a good husband. These things, which are absolutely critical life skills, you know, how to find a good husband and how to raise a well-balanced child and all that, it's just not there in the culture anymore. It's something that you can find if you seek it out, obviously, but you could find about model railways if you were to seek it out. You could find knowledge about some obscure hobby, and it's basically at the same level now. So I think that the whole culture has been reshaped so as to discourage family formation, and I think that is probably the number one reason why people don't do it. It doesn't fit into the life that they have been encouraged to imagine having. Their future is one in which they are a fun-loving teenager, 20-something, forever. And the idea of giving that up to become a parent is just anathema to them now, to a lot of people. What would you say about this, Nick?
I would agree. I would agree that I remember, too, like women's magazines, yeah, hell, men's magazine had tips on how to be a better dad. On the male side, I think that the culture has basically been allowing us to act like children. So I'm going to be 30 in less than a month. I'm dreading the date, but I'm amazed to the degree to which I'm just allowed to be a child, even though I am a man. I have been a man for a very long time now, even by, you know, the standards of our society, which are ridiculous. You become a man at 18. I've been a man for 12 years, right?
Yeah.
And if I were to say soy out, you know, jump like the soy jack over product, society would not judge me for it. They would comment on it, you know, that maybe I'm a little bit of a loser. But you don't really hear anyone say,
but it would be in a cute way, like he's a bit of a loser. Yeah, he loves his Nintendo DS. Oh, look at him!
Right.
What a guy.
it's no. You don't hear the phrase "be a man" anymore, right? Whereas all in the 90s, you heard it even in a Disney film in Mulan. They even had a song about being a man. Of course, it was aimed at women, at girls, but still, you heard that phrase: "Be a man, walk like a man. Don't walk like a boy." And the contrast wasn't like in today's context. When someone questions your manhood, the implication is that you're a woman or a eunuch or a homosexual of any type. But back in the day, you look at older media. The negative, the hidden implication, the hidden contrast implied in "be a man" is you're being a boy, right? Men were contrasted with boys, not with women. You cannot become a woman as a man in the traditional conception. You can remain a boy or you can become a man. There's no path to womanhood, right? And That urge you spoke about, I felt it all the way back when I was 15, but, you know, I'm a Mediterranean. We have shorter life cycles, I guess. And nobody encouraged me to act on it. Nobody encouraged me in 15 years to act on it, except the dissident, right? You know, you had to find strangers of the internet to tell you, yeah, you, if you want to have children, you should have children. It's something you should do. You should become a man. You know, I find this very interesting. I used to buy toys. This is a little embarrassing for me here, but I have a lot of plush toys, right? And I used to buy them a lot because they're an easy gift. You know, Mrs. Gilby used to buy them for me because they're an easy gift. You buy someone a plush puppy or a plush bear, and they're happy and it looks nice. But I've made a decision. I'm not going to buy another toy until I have children on my own. And all the toys I currently have, well, I do not own them. I am holding them in trust for my children, right? I do not own any toys, right? But I'm not going to throw them out because they're very nice. They're high quality, most of them. And I've shown my my dollies here sometimes on stream. It's a decision you have to make. It's an idea space you have to inhabit, that you are a man and not a boy. That doesn't mean you're never going to play video games ever again. That doesn't mean you're not going to goof off with the lads, but it means you start inhabiting this different conceptual space. No more boys, right? You're a man now. Maybe you should have like a bar mitzvah, like a ritual where you formally become a man. Maybe we should reinstate that as a culture. We have lost that. Jews still have it. You know, they have bar mitzvahs. I think other cultures do too. But
yeah,
it's not so much the formal thing. The formal thing is to shock the young man into thinking like a man. But you really have to start inhabiting the idea space I'm a man now. That's one aspect of, as to the economic aspect of it, I think it's overblown. You think about the Irish immigrants to the United States. They're living in apartments that would make the pod, the Klaus Schwab pod, look habitable, but they're having 12 children per woman, you know, yeah, 12, 15 children per woman. They're living on literal scraps, on rotting bread and whatever. And they're having, oodles of children. You know, the old joke about the Irish family, Patrick and Mary met on the boat to America, and they had 12 children, of which 6 died, and 3 of the 6 that lived, 3 were girls and 3 were boys. And the first boy became a priest, and the second boy became a criminal, and the third one became a policeman. And you can have 12 children in a literal pod. Yeah, 6 of them may die, and they're all Irish, but hey, you had 12 children. So I don't think the economic incentives are that big a factor.
Yeah. Other people have said this, that it's really not that expensive to raise a kid and to raise multiple kids, because they can just inherit each other's clothes, you know, hand-me-downs. So it's actually not, you know, it's overblown. This whole thing about it costing a fortune to raise a kid, it can cost a fortune to raise a kid. And indeed, I know people who absolutely lavish their children with presents and clothes and stuff that they clearly don't need. I do know people like that, and Christmases are obscene in that regard. Like, the kid will get like 40, 50 presents. It's just absolutely unbelievable. So it can cost a fortune, but I think that's largely down to the culture. I think the culture, it's amazing how dysfunctional our culture is, how many bad things it trains into people. And one of them is that it trains you to spend an absolute fortune on each child, so as to limit how many children you will have. Destructive, malicious, nasty, counterproductive, unhealthy. It's all of these things where we could at any time, we could have a culture that was much more healthy. But for historical reasons, we just don't. We have one that is constantly working against us.
People in the chat are saying that the biggest expense with regard to children is education. Well, you know, when I have children and when it comes to the time comes to educate them, I'm just going to have, the fine people at Countercurrents, all of those PhDs, draft a curriculum for me, and I'm just going to teach my children myself. I will move to a location which allows homeschooling if need be, but I'm not giving my children over to the brainwashing factory. I'm a clever guy, and so is the missus. We can develop a full school curriculum for our children, and we could even make it available for the broader dissident right to use. We should have one of these lying around. We should have, Countercurrents is the university of the dissident right, but we also need a high school and a grade school and a grammar school of the dissident right. So that's very an important part of it. Another thing I noticed is that children today are, I'm just going to come out and say it, fucking rude. They are rude, and I think it's because they're spoiled. I think it's because they have noticed this, that basically they treat me and other adults with disrespect. And I thought, it's like maybe it's the declining social trust thing, but no, they treat their parents with disrespect. They treat their grandparents disrespectfully. And part of it is probably because we're lavishing children with just so much stuff. So yeah, raising children, if you're raising ungrateful little gargoyles, which are rude to passers-by, yeah, I guess that is expensive because they have to have the latest gadgets. But, if they have to make do with a flip phone, maybe these children will be more polite and you can afford to have more of them. I mean, I remember a time, I was born in the 90s, where I didn't have a phone as a child. I had my first phone when I was 12. And it had polyphonous melodies, and it was still a feat. It came from a wealthy family, and so I had a phone pretty early on. But it was a big privilege, right? So maybe we shouldn't be lavishing so much stuff on our children. Maybe we should be paying them more attention, now, not to coddle them, but to discipline them, but just pouring money into them, throwing money at what is supposed to be the Ausbildung of the next generation. I don't think that solves any problems.
Yeah, indeed. It acclimatizes them to plenty, to expect plenty in the future, which is, it's not a good idea. It's not doing them a favor. So there were two super chats that came in. Woe's great post on Telegram that references Nixie's piece about the normie question. I'm not a normieist. Some of my best friends are normies. Well, thank you very much, Gaudius Maximus. And I've linked it, the post, in the Odyssey chat for anyone who's curious. I, by the way, I should say I can't post things in the DLive chat because I'm banned from DLive. So that's why I'm missing an action there. And I never use it for my own stuff. So that's why I haven't bothered to create a SOC account. Sorry about that. And then there was one from the Horatio Nelson. And he says, Z-Man had a great podcast this week about identifying and dealing with witches. It was inspired by the Ed Dutton book about witches. But the witches he talks about are leftists, feminists, cult Marxists, and so on. He talks about how to deal with these people. It was funny and full of practical advice. Highly recommended. So that's the podcast by Z-Man from this week. So it's just before the 30th of October. So that's something for people to look out for. So thank you, Horatio Nelson, for that recommendation. I don't think there are any other super chats. If people want to post any, that would be helpful to keep us going for the last 20 minutes. That would be very good. So
Curriculi don't write themselves.
Yes, exactly. So what was I going to say about... well, we covered the economics and why people don't have children. And I think it's... More than anything else, it's the culture, I think. And I would say the same about other things as well. Why do people have promiscuous sex and that kind of thing? I really think that people... yes, economics clearly plays a part in people's choices, but I think most of it is, well, this is what I'm expected to do. This is what I see other people doing. It's what I hear about other people doing on TV and in films. So this is obviously what life is like now. And if I don't do this, then I'm not competing with my peers. I'm not doing what you're supposed to do. So I think a large part of it is that. And also, as you indicated earlier, growing up is difficult. It's a choice, and it's not all that easy. And specifically what I wanted to pick up on was when you said that I can't remember how you phrased it, but I'll phrase it in my own way. Growing up is, in a sense, it's simpler for women. It's simpler for a girl to become a woman, because people don't, and this is a very sexist thing to say, but I think it's a general reality. Women today are expected to grow up in a certain sense, in that they are expected to become independent and have a job, have an apartment of their own, and manage their sex life and their sexual reproductive health, that kind of thing. So in that sense, we actually expect more from women nowadays than we used to, because we never expected them to become independent. But for men, it's a much more complicated matter for a boy to become a man. Because in the end, even if when women fuck up, society, all of society is fashioned to help her, to assist her, to sympathize with her, and rescue her. But for men, that assistance is limited to welfare money. And often, even that is either unavailable or given very resentfully. And there's really nothing else. But psychologically, there's a lot more involved in becoming a man than I think in becoming a woman. The growing up with a woman, the transition from being a girl to being a woman, I think really occurs when she gets married, and then even more so when she becomes a mother. But you cannot say that becoming a man is limited to becoming a father or becoming a husband or becoming a father. There's more to being a man. There's more, and just innately, and this is the case even now in this supposedly very equal age of equality between the sexes. It's a lot more is expected of a man in the dating game and in life, in employment, by society. This is exemplified by the draft, the military draft, where men are expected to take up arms and possibly lose life and limb or risk life and limb in defense of their country. But it's also that they are expected to pay more tax. They're expected to work longer hours. They're expected to come up with ideas. They're expected to be resourceful. They're expected to be resilient. They're expected to be emotionally stable and steady. They're expected, and then all the things in the dating game, they're expected to be witty, charismatic, strong, self-effacing, humble, sensitive to her needs, of course. Being a man is a much more multifarious thing, I think, than being a woman, frankly. And, you know, this is a thing that, you know, people say, oh, women are much more complicated than men. I absolutely don't believe that. I think that men are far more complex than women on the whole. And I don't say that as a criticism of women at all. I just think it's an objective fact.
Yeah, I characterized at one point becoming a man, or really effectuating any transformation in yourself, as a murder-suicide. It's you kill what you were, which is the suicide part, and you kill every other potentiality. You kill the opportunity cost. So when I chose to go to law school and become a lawyer, I not only killed what I hitherto was, an unqualified, unspecialized young man, but I also killed myself as an architect and as a doctor and as a physicist and all of these things I wanted to do, you know, which I was considering aside from law. And after I, you know, began publicly figuring as a dissident right intellectual, I killed what I previously was, and I killed a whole bunch of other optionalities. So this is murder suicide, and it is very traumatic. Transformation is traumatic, and it's very traumatic, specifically if you this is why I liken not just personal growth, this is why I call it a transformation. I think it's an alchemical process. It's not so much biological. The like I said, the difference between a man and a boy is inhabiting different psychological conceptual space. It's not, I mean, yeah, there is a difference between someone age 20 and age 14, physically speaking, but they could be mentally very similar to each other. And this is the scary thing. Men can go on to be boys well into their 50s. I've seen it. It's not pretty. It's not pretty. It's like women can keep on acting like teenagers, even in their 40s and 60s. And I did a review of the, you know, that film, Shirley Valentine. It's one of the greatest, considered actually one of the greatest British films. And I like it, you know, as a silly vacation comedy. But what it is, it's a middle-aged, you know, Liverpudlian woman acting like a teenager. You know, I'm going to go to Greece and make the fuck with this mustachioed Lothario. Okay. This is not what mothers do. This is not what responsible women do. I have an article for Countercurrents. It's called Playing Dress Up. When I say the real transgenderism, the real danger of transgenderism is not from men wearing sundresses. I mean, it's ugly, it's disgusting, but it's statistically insignificant. It's only really important because our elites want to make it important. We, you know, the Brazilians had this she-male phenomenon for years over there. It was just the butt of every joke. It was not the social acid it is in the West. The real transgenderism is the transformation of Western gender rules. Now what it means to be a woman is to be a strong, independent woman who don't need no man. What being a woman used to mean, you obey your husband and you make babies. It's reductionist. It's reductionist, but it's what being a woman used to be. Being a man used to mean a lot of other stuff, you know, a whole bunch of stuff. You know, you have a house, you're a pater familias, you're a father of a family. You can, in a pinch, defend your nation with rifle in hand. It used to mean you have a career, you're contributing to your community, you can feed your children, you can feed your wife. And now even that has transformed. Male gender roles have transitioned to, okay, you be the soyjack, you be the coomer living in the pod, consuming the bugs and the content and the everything else.
Yeah.
So transgenderism. The gender roles are transvaluated.
Yeah. And one thing I'd want to put in here is that I think, as I said earlier, women are now expected to grow up in a sense that they weren't in the past. But I think the effect of that, the result of that, is loads of women ending up on antidepressants, ending up like they're a mess. They've slept around, they've made mistakes, bad decisions, and at best they've got a career. At best they've climbed the career ladder a bit, but you know they're still depressed. I mean, we seem to have an epidemic now of women on antidepressants, which I think that's the result of them trying to be men. You know, the end result is that you've just got loads of women who are broken, and it's tragic. But I do agree with your point that the real casualty of the whole trans thing is not that very small number of people who go into it, although that number is rising. I mean, it's like, apparently, I think it was 10% of Generation Z, the Zoomers, now call themselves trans in some way, non-binary, gender fluid, etc. So that Jesus number is right. Yeah, but let's assume that it's a marked minority, 10% people. The real threat of it is that it destroys the basis for gender roles, for a woman to conceptualize herself as a woman, and all the expectations that go along with that, the stereotypes that go along with it, the conventions, and likewise for a man to conceptualize himself as a man. Because what is a man? It's not only that we no longer have the cultural expectations, we no longer even have the biological classification of a man. You know, the trans thing has eliminated even that. So it's a, but the thing is, everyone knows that this is insane. I mean, I think people know instinctively. Most of the people I met today, like the vast, vast majority of them, if not all of them, clearly fitted into one of two categories. And that's just the way it is. I mean, how many people don't think in those terms? How many people actually think, I've no idea whether that large muscular figure with the deep voice that I bumped into waiting for the bus was a man or a woman? I can't believe that anyone actually thinks that. So in the end, everyone knows that these things are true and real, and that we're in this fiction that they are not real is entirely a cultural phenomenon, and it's at odds with reality. I'm sure that everyone must know that.
Well, they're doing a very good job at hiding it. You step outside of this bubble of the Twitter blue checks and you know, liberal media, people actually can tell shit from Shinola and a man from a woman. And that's, it's what does someone say? A luxury belief, a boutique belief. And it's doubtful they really believe it. I don't want to reveal too much on how I know this, but just take my word for it for now. There is a climate of absolute terror of pissing off big trans in leftist circles. Not even the hard left believes the trans bullshit. They're just terrified of saying no to it. They're just terrified of being labeled TERF. That's the interesting thing. I forget who pointed it out, that the worst thing you can be in the West is a racist. The second worst thing is a TERF, which is a trans exclusionary radical feminist, which is a feminist position that, for those of you who don't know, says that transgenders, well, they're just men colonizing women's spaces. So they're using the language of the left. Obviously, this is a leftist phenomenon. But we should probably call them feminists who are consistent with feminism, right? Because if you had to put a feminist from a feminist perspective, this is exactly what transgenderism is. It's a bunch of guys barging into female spaces and demanding to be treated like women. You know, you can see it in female sports. You can see it in female this and female that. I remember at one point this woman was complaining that they had a chat group about dealing with menstrual pain, and a trans man barged in and demanded to be taken seriously when talking about his non-existent periods and the non-existent menstrual pain he suffered from his non-existent periods. So yeah, from this, there is an epidemic of terror on the far left of being outed as a TERF, because not even they can bring themselves to believe this bullshit, really.
There are two more super chats. So this one is from ABC. One way to make a difference through non-violent means is to forget about the big picture and get involved in local politics. Put in the groundwork mileage, talking and interacting with people. Thoughts? Well, I wouldn't want to discourage that. I just think that local politics is, I don't know, I probably you could make some impact there. probably you could have some influence there. So I don't want to discourage it, and I definitely don't want to encourage people to feel powerless or impotent. All I would say is the big decisions, the real decisions, are not made at the local level. And the most you'll probably be able to do is mount some resistance to them at the local level, I would think. Or you'll be able to influence things that don't really matter to the big picture, like where to site that new leisure centre that's going to be built in this town. Should it be at the West End or should it be at the East End? Or that disused bit in the north, you know, that kind of thing. But that doesn't affect the issues that really animate society. So it depends what you're interested in. I don't think that, you know, I think it's laudable. I think it's good that people are concerned about their local areas and involved in them. And I would never try to diminish that. But I do think that you would be kidding yourself if you said that by getting involved in local politics, you're going to be affecting society at large. But then again, that's not really the point of getting involved in local politics. So, yeah, fair enough. What would you say next?
As someone with some experience with local politics, let's just say experience in local politics, I will say, understand two things. Even if you win, it will probably be a symbolic victory. Most states in the West, in the East, everywhere are just so centralized that local councils and mayors and county this and county that don't really have much power. And even if they do, they still need financing and licensing from the central government. So you're basically just the plaything of the central government. That's the first thing. The second thing is that the bulk of political corruption and graft happens at the local level. So you're not just going to be going against Globo Homo in local politics. You'll be going against entrenched local corrupt interests in all probability, and for very little payoff, I would say. If you really want to do local politics, you would probably be better off working local metapolitics. So we're talking about reproduction. We're talking about children here. Why not try and find, you know, all of the people in your area who are like-minded and start doing things together? You know, even if we have more white babies, it's not going to help if they grow up just with their parents. You know, they're going to have to socialize with other children. So why not locate people who are like-minded? You should hang out with them. And when they have children of their own, their children should be friends with your children. So that's the local politics you should be engaging in. You know, you want to run for mayor, you want to get involved in your local council, be my guest. People have tried that. There's been mixed success. But yeah, even if you win, you can't win in local politics. That is a big problem with local politics. It's also a big problem, you know, with macro politics. There is a lot of graft. There's a lot of corruption. We're not just going against Globo Homo. We are also going against just good old-fashioned graft and corruption as well. And even at the macro level, too. So that's my take on it. I recently bought for my circle of friends around here. We bought Monopoly, you know, the board game. And one of them, he was recently, you could say, a little black-pilled, a little despondent. And I said to them, we have a power that they don't. What's that? We have a board game. You know, what do you need to enjoy a board game? Friends. What do you have that they don't? Friends. You have people to play Monopoly with. You have people to play chess with. And that's, you know, that's why people should watch anime. It teaches you the power of friendship. The power of friendship is what's going to defeat Globo Homo and our enemies. The power of, you know, white men sticking together and looking out for each other's interests. And it starts with board games. It starts with children playing together. It starts with, you know, meeting up to do cool things together, I guess.
Yeah. Okay, I don't disagree with any of that, although I would say that people should be careful about getting addicted to anime.
No, obviously, just use anime in moderation. Yeah. And yes, and let me, kids, you know, just don't look at me. I can quit whenever I want.
Okay. The final one is from Archie, and he says, he mentions a book about resistance. I don't want to name it. And he says, it's emphasized in this book to avoid forming pyramidal hierarchies, because it's exactly what the government likes, so the government can destroy a movement. If the hierarchy doesn't exist, then the government will make one for their enemy. Well, I mean, yeah, that would seem to suggest then that there should be a hierarchy, because otherwise the government, if there isn't one, then the government will make one. So I would say that would suggest that there should be a hierarchy. And the fact that the government will then attack that hierarchy is, well, that's going to happen anyway. I just don't think that anything happens without hierarchy and structure. You know, my experience over the last few 7 years has shown that people are very good at just sort of milling around and arguing and squabbling over nothing if there isn't a definite hierarchy in place. But again, the other thing that's important is that people are getting paid, because if they're not, then they've got no reason to do anything. And nothing gets done. This is why our opposition have such huge funding. It's a difficult problem to solve. Next, would you like to say anything about this? Sorry, Nick.
It's okay. It's I like being compared to the Greek goddess of the night, because we are probing some very dark recesses of thought here. It sounds very glamorous when we're doing it. When we're doing it, really, we are milling around in the basement where everyone put the thought concepts that they thought they no longer needed for civilization. But how to avoid pyramidal hierarchies. Are there any other type of hierarchies that could be on offer? I know the IT people like that distributed lattice thing, but does anything of that sort really look like? And everyone brings up the Ba'ath Party from the Saddam Hussein years. But all of those guys, yeah, they were pretty decentralized. But they were still all subordinate to Saddam Hussein. And when Saddam Hussein was captured, he wasn't even captured. Like, the second Saddam Hussein lost control of his command and control apparatus, it didn't matter that he was alive. It didn't matter that he wasn't captured yet. The Ba'ath Party just disintegrated in Iraq. And all hierarchies are prone to leader failure. You take out the leader, you compromise him in some other way, or just cut him off from the command and control apparatus. It's going to go, unless you actually take the old Prussian model, where basically every field commander has the initiative and the training of a field marshal. But, if you take the old Prussian model, you start behaving like those old Prussian guys, and they evolved into, well, our uncle with the mustache, as you could say. And that's going to attract a lot of attention, because organizational form will dictate a lot more than just, just the way your organization is structured. So I don't know how to answer that. How do we organize without pyramidal hierarchy? Yeah, we know the vulnerabilities of pyramidal hierarchy, but are there any other types of hierarchies we could implement? There's no doing this without hierarchy. I completely agree on that. At some point, somebody is going to have to subordinate his will to someone else, and that's how things are going to get done. At some point, somebody has to organize and concentrate forces towards a specific goal, and that's how things are going to get done. That's what hierarchy does for you. That's what money does for you. But money's useless without hierarchy, and hierarchy, it's not useless without money, but it contains within itself the potentiality to start earning money. Maybe it's like the old, Tony Soprano says, money flows up, shit flows down. From the high, that's how this describes hierarchy.
Yeah.
This thing's been a pyramid since time immemorial. Yeah. You know,
I think that something our opposition have done is work out ways of making things self-sustaining, self-sufficient. So something will make money and it is good for their cause. And I really wish that we could work out that trick, how to do that, because it's ultimately what's going to be needed, I think. But anyway, we should end it there, because we have gone for 2 hours.
If I can just finish my thought here, this is why you should have this circle of friends, right? If nothing comes to nothing, you know, you're still going to have friends at the end of the day. You're still going to have people to help you move, you know, move heavy objects around town. You're still going to have people you can call to hang out with, which is more than modern people can say. But if we can organize at the central level, what you're going to do, you're going to be in a position to deliver to the movement a group of people ready to serve in its ranks. And that will be appreciated, and that will be respected, and ultimately, God willing, rewarded. So I will definitely encourage people to organize at the local level for the time being, just to be friends and just to do cool things together. But in the future, who knows?
All right. Well, let's leave it at that. So thank you for tuning in. I know this hasn't been the sort of typical Countercurrents podcast. You're used to the redoubtable Greg Johnson being hosting. So I'm sorry that he wasn't available tonight. But anyway, hopefully you've all enjoyed this and you'll tune in again next week. In the meantime, I should say that you can find me. I do a Monday night podcast on Telegram, which is at Millennial Woes on Telegram. That's at 10 p.m. GMT, which is 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Every Monday, so I'll be doing that tomorrow night. And Nick, where can people find you?
You can always find me on countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com/author/NR Gilvey. That's the archive of the things I write for Countercurrents. And I'm also the host of the Writer's Block, which will be on tomorrow at 10 p.m. Central European time. That's 4 p.m. on the American East Coast. That's 9 p.m. In the United Kingdom. And I'll be having on James O'Meara. We will be having a very special spooky Writer's Block for Halloween. And we'll be discussing the occult. We'll be discussing magic. James is an accomplished war mage, and he will be teaching us how to turn antifas into newts, spiders, and other creepy crawlies for easier squishing. So would you join us on this same bat channel, different bat time, as Greg would put it, the Countercurrents D-Live and Odyssey channels. This is where it will transpire.
All right. And of course, my show is not tomorrow night. Sorry, I misspoke. It's the night after tomorrow night. So yeah, tune in tomorrow for Nick's and James. All right. In the meantime, thank you everyone for tuning in, and we'll all see you again later.
Take care.